Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. So the football season's picking up a little bit. We're going to get into that with the NFL with John Murray tomorrow. We're also going to do UFC preview as the UFC organization shifts to Fight Island for five straight cards. So Matt and Lou will be on the NFL podcast tomorrow. Today is all college football, and we're previewing the start of the SEC season. And a lot of moving parts, obviously, this year with the college football and COVID and everything. So it's a delayed start for the SEC. Brad Edwards, who you guys know from past podcasts and ESPN.com's analytics division, also College Game Day on ESPN Radio. My former co-host has been doing that for nearly two decades. So he's wonderful with college football, especially the SEC. So we're going to dive deep into a few teams. He's going to give us a little background on, you know, what he's read, what he has seen, the things he's hearing. And really, it's a crash course of the SEC. So I think it's going to be really interesting because Brad is full of knowledge, full of insight, and gets us all ready to handicap the upcoming season. Again, tomorrow NFL and UFC, but coming up here, it's going to be Brad Edwards on the SEC as we break down and look at even some win totals, if you can find them out there. But before we get into today's episode, I want to remind everyone to go check out another ESPN podcast that will help you with fantasy football teams. Make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts Matthew Berry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy, previews, and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you'll need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
All right, let's get things started with a friend of the program, one of my buddies and former co-hosts of College Game Day on ESPN Radio. A man we have heard many times here on the podcast, Brad Edwards. How are you, my man?
I'm doing great. I can't wait for the SEC teams to take the field this weekend. I don't want to make that sound like I didn't enjoy there being college football the previous 3 weeks, but it's just felt like preseason with so many of the best teams not playing. And so I think it's going to feel more like a real season. Maybe not quite there yet. We're still waiting for the Big Ten, obviously, but yeah, if you're a lover of college football, it just hasn't felt right.
No, that's a great point. I think preseason's fair because it's not just the SEC. It's the Big Ten, as you alluded to, and even the Pac-12. Just some of those mainstays. And, you know, we've been joking on the podcast or on Daily Wager. I was like, you know, we don't have the Hawaii game or the Pac-12 after dark bailout right. bets to the midnight. I always joke like the UFC main event is the new bailout bet. But – no, it's been great in terms of in general, like where we could be, you know, where we thought we might have to like miss an entire season across the board a few months ago just to have these games. But I guess before we get into the SEC, Brad, what are your early impressions of just maybe Clemson, obviously in the mix, the number one team in the country they've played, but just overall the teams you have seen play and kind of get that vibe from college football?
Yeah, you know, Clemson's looked good out of the gate in both games and then took its foot off the gas. So maybe their final scores were a little bit misleading, but I think what you're looking for from them, you saw it. Most of the other teams, though, there have been a few surprises, but most of them have just been kind of rusty, which is not surprising considering how many of them had little or no spring practice. And you know, a lot of fall camp was kind of disjointed with guys having to sit out here and there and you know, the contact practices being spaced out a lot more than they were for some of these schools. And so nothing's been normal, and a lot of the teams have come out and played like it. And, you know, I mean, Oklahoma State last weekend is a great example. I mean, sure, the starting quarterback did go out in the first half, and that explains some of it. But how does that team not score more against Tulsa? And I don't think that it's an isolated incident. I think you're going to see more of it as more teams. And it's not just the SEC, by the way, this weekend. I mean, that's 14 new teams. But I think there are about 10 others outside of the SEC. They're going to take the field for the first time in conferences where most everyone else has already played, but they're coming out for the first time. So just, you know, teams looking rusty has just kind of become the norm.
No, it's a great point. And I'm going to get, because I think there's some bottom, I don't want to say bottom feeders, but bottom tier teams in the SEC that I think really interest me. And let's get into that, because we've have a lot of coaching turnover, all things considered, in the conference. And you have some high profile guys like Lane Kiffin, Mike Leach. I mean, right then and there, I mean, just one of those guys is interesting and compelling and bulletin board material with their comments. But we get both of those guys in the SEC and kind of, I don't want to say making schools that are irrelevant relevant, but certainly bringing attention to programs that maybe weren't, didn't have our attention. I mean, Ole Miss did a few years ago when they were, one or two with them and their rivals. But, you know, since then with the sanctions and all that, the Hugh Freeze stuff, we've kind of forgotten about Ole Miss, and it's just to have them back in the mix. And I'm intrigued, and Leach has put together an interesting staff as well, brought over some familiar faces and the quarterbacks as well. So what do you make of what they're going to be trying to do with Mississippi State and Ole Miss?
Yeah, I think this is going to be fascinating to see what happens with both of these teams, not only because of the coaches and just their personalities, but because both of them are offensive guys. Mm-hmm. And they have very compelling quarterback situations to keep an eye on. I mean, with Ole Miss, obviously, is a team that used two different guys last year, one of them much more of a runner. And you know, what direction is Lane Kiffin going to go here? And, of course, you hate to be the first team to play them because you'd like to have a little bit of an answer as you try to prepare for them. But Florida's not going to have that luxury. And if you try to go back to Kiffin's time at Alabama, I mean, he was offensive coordinator for three seasons using three quarterbacks who had a completely different skill set from one another. And he basically ran three different types of offenses in order to account for it. And so with that in mind, I think he could have completely different packages with these two guys, you know, where they're not necessarily even running the same plays when they're on the field, or at least not a lot of them. So I think that's compelling with Ole Miss. And then with Mississippi State, you know, KJ Costello coming in from Stanford, it's interesting because here's a guy who was in a much different type of offense, that's putting it mildly, at Stanford than what Leach ran at Washington State, but a guy who had the opportunity to stand on the sideline and watch Leach's offense up close and personal as an opponent a couple of times, and he knows exactly what he's doing. And he obviously saw himself as a good fit in that offense in order to make that move. And you would assume that Leach thought he was a good fit as well. And it's going to be, once again, it's another one of those offenses that I think is going to be difficult to prepare for, not only because of all the losses that LSU had defensively from last year, including, you know, having a new coordinator, but also because this is the type of offense that you just haven't really seen in the SEC. And so I think both of those guys present some really interesting situations for their opponents to prepare for in this first game.
And I think Leach's track record of QBs, like, he really hasn't like made the wrong choice. I mean, look what Gardner Minshew is doing in the NFL. It's insane. And then even the years where he wasn't, you know, a high profile, then like the offense was not the issue. Like last year, you know, that thriller against UCLA, we all remember the offense was fine. They put up like 70 points. So you can say what you want about, oh, Pac-12 doesn't play defense. Yeah, but it's also got, like, really good quarterback play and really good offensive minds. And are they SEC-type defenses they're facing? Of course not. But I also don't think that you shouldn't just blame bad defense for all the strong performances on offense.
No, and look, you know, as you know, I do a lot with analytics and advanced stats. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I spend a lot of time looking at is our FPI. And Mississippi State is a situation where I think we could really be underestimating Mississippi State because of two things. One is that the quarterback, KJ Costello, our priors are looking at what a quarterback did last year if he's a transfer. Costello, you know, didn't play a lot of the season because of injury, but he also didn't play as well as he did the previous year. And so much like Derek King at Miami, if he goes out and plays like he did in 2018, you know, you're looking at a pretty significant upgrade at quarterback. And so that's something that FPI could be missing, even though we are in some way accounting for Costello being in there. And of course, the other thing is that with Leach, FPI does not account for a head coach specifically. It knows that there's a new head coach. And the assumption is, and the reason this assumption exists is because it is true most of the time, that a coaching transition takes a little while, and it's normally not all that successful in year one. And looking at what Mississippi State had coming back on offense, there's every reason to believe in a normal scenario that they might be an average to below average offensive team. But that's not Mike Leach's track record, obviously. When has Mike Leach ever had a below average or even an average offense? Probably not. So I think their offense is going to be better than we're expecting. And so this is one of those teams that I'm really afraid to look at FPI and use that as a gauge for what to expect with Mississippi State, because there are a few factors that they have going that are just difficult to account for.
And I'm glad you went into that, because I think Leach is fascinating, especially for the opener. And you mentioned LSU, so let's get into that. I wanted to touch on Kiffin and Leach, and then obviously LSU, the defending champion, both in the conference and the nation, and they lose. You mentioned the coordinator, both coordinators, 15 players to the NFL on top of a guy who's going to sit out a stud wide receiver. Now, look, it's LSU that's reloading, so obviously that speaks volumes. But it's also the SEC. There's Bama. Let's not forget about them and some other schools. So how do you expect LSU to look, at least early on? I know for those listening, they're laying 16.5 against Mississippi State and Baton Rouge. I would look at the Bulldogs more than anything, but I just got to look what they did last year, and having Brady as the OC and Burrow obviously was spectacular. It's, you don't just reload and look like that.
No, you don't. And I mean, they had arguably the best offense in college football history, and they are returning two starters from that offense. And as you mentioned, on top of it, they're losing Joe Brady, who, even though he wasn't the offensive coordinator by title, was generally considered to be the brains behind that operation. And so that's a lot to replace. Now, I'm sure conceptually they're going to continue to do the same things, you know, that they're going to open it up, go 3 and 4 wide. They're going to throw a lot on first down. They're going to be really aggressive. But there's no way that the personnel that they have out there, at least at this stage of their careers and this stage of the season, are going to be close to what they were the last time that they stepped on the field against Clemson. There's going to be a drop off. And so that is part of this. Of course, the other side with LSU, there's a reason that teams very rarely repeat as national champions. You know, there's this complacency that sets in. And I think especially in the case of LSU, where so few people were picking them to even make the playoff before the season, much less win the national title, they were well served to be congratulating themselves a lot in the offseason. You know, they proved a lot of doubters wrong all the way up to the very end. And you throw that on top of the normal complacency and the challenge of replacing, you know, important players that have departed. And I think it just takes it to a different level. So I will be incredibly impressed with LSU if they go out there and just take care of business and handle Mississippi State easily, because there are just so many things that for a normal team would be negatives, in the column for LSU. And so lots of areas for concern, and we'll see how those play out. But you combine that with going against Mike Leach and some of the issues that come along with that. And by the way, if you want to throw in one more, the fact that playing at Tiger Stadium is not what it's
just about
to
be,
because it's only going to be 1/4 full.
I was just about to ask you that, because I wrote a column talking to a lot of analytics and odds makers just about the NFL. And I'm not sure if you read it or not, but basically fascinating stats for me is like the last five. First of all, just last year, the average point spread for a home team was like 1.6, which was the third lowest in the Super Bowl era, which is 1966. And road teams covered more last year than they have in any year. In fact, the last 5-10 years is basically just the trend is like all road teams is better to bet on than against. And just basically there's been perception hasn't met reality, that going on the road is a lot easier now than it used to be. And it's because of technology, travel conditions like private planes and all that stuff, and then just communication, so the technology and the helmet, and then also that some of it was misconception, like the Seattle Seahawks were amazing at home, right? The 12th man was actually when the team was really good. It was like they were like 34-6 or something in
That's
5 years,
always is.
Right? But when they're like not that good, they're like 14-10 or whatever the numbers are, you know. So it's like, yeah, it's tough to play, but it's really just tough to play a good team. And so some of that is a little misleading. So my question is, and you've mentioned FBI and other analytics. I'm curious because I think college players aren't as, you know, battle tested, if you will, as NFL, like the cream of the crop, so to speak, especially quarterbacks. And, you know, it's just, I've been to Death Valley, and frankly, I've been to NFL stadiums. It's just different, and it's bigger, and you have, it's more vertical. Like they're more on top of you at some of these college venues than they are in the NFL. The NFL kind of geared towards the suites, right? Like, I'm sure Arrowhead and Seattle are great. I've been to Arrowhead, but I haven't been to Seattle. But like for the most part, they're corporate kind of suites. Whereas these college fan bases, it's just rowdy and it's just nuts. Now, without that, how do you think it's going to, like, how much of an edge is LSU losing?
I don't know that it's significant. I mean, it's an afternoon game, not a night game. And there's always been a little bit of a difference for LSU with those two. And then on top of it, you know, they're a big favorite. And so you wouldn't have the same type of crowd fervor for Mississippi State as you would for Alabama, obviously. Mm-hmm. Or like that Florida game last year was nuts. So it was never going to be their craziest crowd of the season. But it still is a big deal because, as you said, college kids have a tendency to be more affected when things start to go the wrong way and the crowd starts to get loud. And that's just more than likely not going to be a factor here. And so, you know, I think it helps, especially when you've got a group that is learning new schemes on both sides of the ball. For Mississippi State, they're going to make some mistakes. But I think LSU will too, just because, you know, as we've noted, they have so many new faces in starting roles. So there could be, you know, a lot of sloppiness in that game. And because of that, like I said, I will just be incredibly impressed if LSU just goes out there and really controls this game from start to finish. I don't think Mississippi State is nearly as good as LSU, and I think the standings will bear that out at the end of the season. But if you're going to catch LSU, early season is the best time to do it.
Yeah, this is because all the moving parts, the unknown with Leach and the unknown with Kiffin, those are the times that they're going to have a puncher's chance. We'll get to Ole Miss's first opponent, which is Florida, in a little bit. But, you know, because we mentioned LSU here at ESPN, we are contractually obligated to mention Alabama. And, you know, their back is the favorite after not going to the playoff for the first time in the college football playoffs existence. It took two regular season losses, an injury to a generational quarterback in Tua, and LSU, like you said, had a remarkable year, arguably the best offense ever. So it's not just about Alabama's injuries and whatnot. Like LSU was the best team by far, you know, clearly, not to say by far, but clearly in that conference. And they showed it in Tuscaloosa, but what a game that was. And what do we know with what's coming back? For so long, it was all about Tua. You know, he replaced Hurts in the championship game, and then he was, you know, Tua, obviously the dynamic offense, the first half covers we had a good time with. But like, I don't know much about this Alabama. They have two quarterbacks. Like, what can we expect here from the Crimson Tide?
Yeah, I think that Alabama fans were very encouraged by the depth chart that was released this week. This is the first time that they've seen a depth chart. And look, like most teams, media have not had the same access to practice that they normally do. And so I think that there's a lot of mystery around a whole lot of teams out there as far as, you know, what's going on, what possibly could have happened as far as injuries or opt-outs that somehow they were able to keep quiet that, you know, that we won't know about until the very beginning. And I still think there's a chance for some of that on Saturday, you know, around college football. But looking at Alabama's depth chart, all the names that you were expecting to see there, they were there, and they were in the places on the depth chart you thought that they would be. And that tells me that they more than likely made it through practice without any significant injuries to this point, which is something that they had not been very fortunate with in recent seasons. And it also suggests that they have not had any key opt-outs. So when you compare that to some other teams, it puts them in an advantageous position, not just for week one, obviously going against a Missouri team that's going to be without several players due to COVID. But you look around the league, you know, season-wide, and you're talking about, you know, handicapping the race for the conference title. We've documented everything that LSU lost. Well, Georgia, who was another team that, you know, figured to be primary competition for Alabama, they have to improve greatly on offense, and they thought they might have an answer with a transfer quarterback, Jamie Newman, and then he opted out. Dominic Blaylock, who's one of their better returning receivers, he was injured, apparently out for the year. So while the other challengers were taking hits to their roster, Alabama appears to just kind of cruise through, and we'll see how good they are. I do think quarterback is worth keeping an eye on. But Mac Jones, a lot of people are just going to remember the two pick sixes he threw against Auburn that very well could have kept Alabama out of the playoff when all was said and done. But outside of those two plays, and they were huge plays, but the last two games against Auburn and Michigan, two good to very good defensive teams, he played really well. And I think, you know, for a guy who was not the starter for most of last season, they feel pretty confident in what they're getting with him. Like, they know what they're getting because they've seen him not just start four games, but two of them against good defensive teams, and he handled it well. And so I think they know what they have there. The question is, do they have something even better with the true freshman backup, Bryce Young? And that's what's going to be interesting because, look, 3 years in a row, Doug, you know this, Alabama has had to go to its backup quarterback in a key situation. Obviously last year, Mac Jones had to come in and start against Auburn because of Tua's, you know, injury situation. And obviously, you know, started the bowl game as well. The year before, Jalen Hurts had to come in the second half against Georgia in the SEC championship game. And then who would ever forget the national championship second half the year before that with Tua coming in to replace Hurts. And so if anyone knows you've got to have a backup ready to play, it's Saban. And I think especially in this year where you have no idea, and this applies to everyone in college football, from week to week, you have no idea how many backups are going to be forced into starting roles because of positive tests and contact tracing and all that stuff, not to mention regular injuries. So you've got to have everyone who's capable of contributing ready to play, which I think, you know, teams like Alabama that are likely to get out to big leads, they're going to play more backups, and they're probably going to be aggressive when they do. It's not going to be a take your foot off the gas approach. I've been a little surprised that Clemson has done that. You've not seen Clemson's backups keep the pedal down the way that they did in the last couple of years. But I think Alabama, when they do have the backup quarterback in, they'll probably put him in for the first possession or two still with the starting line and starting receivers. And I think they're going to let him throw. So I don't expect that Alabama's offense is going to let up. And that's not just for week one. I think that's for any game that they play that's not competitive, because Saban knows he needs to have two quarterbacks ready to play.
So that's food for thought when laying big numbers like this weekend against Mizzou. I have a question for Mac Jones topic, because I live bet Tennessee last year because he looked scared. And, you know, who knows if they don't – forget the name, Guarantamo, or doesn't audible out of that goal line, and there's the 100-yard scoop and score. Who knows what happens there? But I think Mac Jones did look good against Michigan. I just think one team was ready. I think Michigan had some guys on D opt out. And also, I mean, they had those wide receivers that I could have thrown some slants for touchdowns too. So how does Bama look at the wide receiver position after losing all those guys to the NFL, especially Ruggs and the speed? Like, some of that was making Mac Jones look good. Now, it's Alabama. I would imagine they reload. So I'm curious how potent they are at wide receiver.
Yeah, they I think Alabama's going to be okay. You know, there's certain teams at certain positions that you don't really worry about them, I guess is the way to say it. It's really a question of who they're going to be. They've had some big-time recruits over the last couple of years that would be the logical replacements as you look at Judy and Ruggs and what are they going to do there. I think they're still not likely to be potent at tight end. They do have a transfer from North Carolina who's going to get some reps, but I don't think they're going to do a lot with the tight end in the passing game. It's going to be mostly wideouts. There's a kid named John Mechie who played some last year, but he never really did anything that jumped out. And the fact that the rotation was pretty much kept to those four guys made me believe that, you know what, maybe, and look, we know how good those four guys were last year, you know, but maybe no one else is quite on that level, which is why they're not getting into the rotation that much. But I've been hearing good things about him. and about at least one freshman, and they seem to always have a freshman who's going to jump off the page at you. And then, you know, and then they have another kid who's really more of a all-purpose type guy who they can use in a lot of different ways, who's going to line up in the slot and you know, maybe do some Christian McCaffrey type things. So I think that they're still going to have plenty of weapons in the passing game. So I wouldn't worry about the potency of that offense, even though obviously no one game one is going to be what Judy and Ruggs were at the end of last season.
That's fair. Do you have faith in Sarkisian?
Well, here's where it could be a little bit different for Alabama is that, you know, 2 years ago, it was heavy RPO with Tua because he was so good at the RPO game. And then last year, obviously, they kept doing it because Tua was so good at it. But that's not really what Sark wants to do. And I think when Mac Jones became the quarterback late in the year, you saw a little bit more of the pro style and West Coast stuff that, you know, that's really been more his game. And I think it fits better with Jones. I think it'll be, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether there's a noticeable difference in the way that Alabama's calling plays. One other thing about that offense that really jumped out last year is that Najee Harris, who, you know, obviously a really good running back and a big running back.
Oh, yeah.
Showed his versatility last year that he was really dangerous in the passing game. I want to say he had like something like six touchdown catches last year. So that's something I think to keep an eye on. It's not just that Alabama has the ability to run the ball as they always do, but that they have a running back who's dangerous as a pass catcher and not necessarily a guy who looks the part of a running back who would be dangerous as a receiver. So they like I said, they've got a little bit of everything except the pass catching tight end threat. It just seems to be the one thing that they're missing that really most of Saban's time, they haven't had that guy anyway, or when they have had them or had that guy, they haven't used him. So it's going to be a little bit different because there's no Tua, but I think in a lot of ways, you know, they're going to be just as dangerous as they were before.
Okay. Interesting. Harris had seven receiving touchdowns, actually.
Seven. Yeah. I mean,
last year. So, and but, you're right. He is just a beast and just a physical, you know.
Yeah, that's the thing. He doesn't look like a running back who would have seven touchdown receptions.
But either did Edwards-Helaire, right? Like he was, I mean, he had a little like stockiness to him, but he was a pretty thick dude. Now Harris is bigger and taller, but still like, you know, that was interesting last year with the Tigers. Let's go to Georgia. You mentioned Jamie Newman, the transfer. So there was a lot of expectations for him coming to a team that's currently ranked fourth in the country, but he opts out. And, you know, let's face it, Kirby, you know, the bar is set really high for Kirby Smart, and they were right there. You mentioned Hurts having to bail out Tua in the SEC title game, and even going back to Mark Richt when they had, you know, the stubbed their toe a few times, and Murray down and near the goal line and ran out of time. I mean, Georgia's been right there a couple times, but then they've also, like, lost. Like, South Carolina was a bad loss last year, and they've been there, but it just shows you how special Saban and company are. So I guess my question is, what are you expecting from this Georgia team? Can they finally get over the hump?
Well, I think last year, not only losing to South Carolina, but also the way that they lost to LSU in the SEC championship game. Now, they did have some players out, and that was going to be an uphill battle from the start. But they got blown out, and the game really was realistically over by halftime. And that was a punch in the gut to a team that has the type of talent that Georgia has. And I think it was a wake-up call in the same way that LSU had wake-up calls in previous seasons where they're getting shut out by Alabama. And it's like, you know what? We have to get not just better, but much better on offense in order to truly contend, not just for the SEC title, but for the national title. LSU obviously made some changes and they did that. That's what Georgia was hoping to do this offseason, you know, bringing in Todd Monken as a new offensive coordinator. They had to replace, you know, the Jake Fromm at quarterback. But how quickly do I forget Jake Fromm's name after he was a fixture for 3 years? But, you know, and so they brought in Newman, and of course Newman opts out. And so now there's kind of this question is, all right, what are they going to do? Everyone was assuming it's JT Daniels who transferred from USC. But Daniels, as of now, has not yet been cleared medically for contact. And so there's no way he's going to start the opener. Dewan Mathis, who is more of a dual threat guy, is going to end up being the starter. And that ultimately, whether it's, you know, through a traditional passing game or whether it's through a dual threat guy, it doesn't matter. Georgia has to get better on offense. They don't necessarily have to be elite, though. As much as I would point to recent seasons as examples that, look, a great offense is going to beat a great defense almost every time these days in college football, Georgia's defense is so good that I just think that they need to be above average on offense. It's kind of like Oklahoma in recent years, where they were so good on offense, they just needed to be decent on defense. You know, and I don't know that it necessarily translates exactly the same, because offense is more important, but they need to be well above average, not necessarily elite. And I think that's the question. Can they do that? Certainly, based on recruiting, they have the players there. Just can they put it together? Do they have the right coach with the right quarterback running the right system? They have a lot to replace from last year, not just Fromm. You know, we talked about positions where you don't worry about certain teams. Georgia running back is one of those. They lost their top two rushers from last year, but I'm sure they've got three or four more guys. Zamir White is probably going to be the starter. And then offensive line, even though they lost arguably four starters, some Georgia fans would claim it's only three. They had a lot of guys rotating in and out. There's still some experience there. So they've got the guys. It's just a question of can they all get on the same page and put it together, because they've got Alabama relatively early in the season. It's game four. And so I think you'll know a lot about Georgia pretty quickly. They've got Auburn week two. Okay, so this is one of those where if they're not ready and the offense is not clicking at all, Georgia could start 2-2, which just, I mean, you talk about the sky falling in Athens. I don't know what they would do if that happened, but the season's just going to be weird, because especially a league like the SEC where it's all conference games, you know, you get the wrong order. Excuse me a second. Let me turn off my little phone here. But when you get the games in the wrong order where it's front loaded, where you're used to kind of easing into it with these non-conference cupcakes, like it can shake you up in a hurry if you don't play well.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the offensive line. That was the reason I picked South Carolina last year. Now, I didn't pick them to win outright, but I took the 18 because I just thought, you know, I had Georgia in the opener against Vanderbilt, and they got stonewalled fourth and short a couple times, and I was just a little worried about it. So you're right. The running backs, they just reload there in Athens. But the offense needed to improve to compete. I mean, look what Auburn's doing with Malzahn, right? They bring Nix, didn't have the best season, but he was certainly looks good moving forward. Even Tennessee improved at the QB position. Alabama, obviously, we know about. And Florida got better. And Arkansas has Felipe Franks. So you're right. They might start 2-2. They could start 1-3. They get Auburn at home. They have to go at Alabama. But Tennessee, you never know with what they're going to look like this year. I wouldn't expect them to win at Georgia. But I'm really down on Georgia this year. I honestly am. I think they're going to be a giant disappointment by their standards.
You know, Doug, one thing for people to keep in mind, because I know you'll get into at some point win totals, and I'm very interested to see what happens with some of the teams that have really high expectations if they get off to a bad start, because we know that this is a season where no one's losing a year of eligibility. You know, that whether they play or don't play, they're going to have the same number of years, you know, remaining after the season. And that's why you've seen some guys opt out. And it's, you know, obviously everyone is going to accept COVID related reasons for opting out. And it's not going to be that big of a deal, even though it hurts. But I'm really intrigued to see whether if a team like a Georgia were to start 2-2 or 2-3, as you said, if it were, let's just say it's 2-2. And what if there are, you know, a few guys in that roster who see themselves having an NFL future, and it's like they don't want to put that on the line for a team that obviously is not going to win the national championship at this point? You know, do you start having these like phantom nagging ankle injuries or whatever, and somebody can't get back on the field. I just think, and I'm not specifying Georgia here, but I think in general, teams that have high expectations, if they get off to slow starts and they know that they're not going to meet the team goals, if there was ever a year where you're not going to catch as much heat as you normally would for, you know, coming up with some injury and not continuing to play, it would be this year. And so I think it's something to keep an eye on as to whether that would happen. You know, guys who came back and had this goal of winning a championship, and it becomes evident it's not going to happen, do they opt out, so to speak, without officially opting out?
Right, and maintain faith, so to speak, from the fan base and things like that. It's a great point, because after Bama, they got to go at Kentucky, host Florida. They would think they went at Mizzou, but then they get, you know, Mississippi State and out at South Carolina. So it is kind of like their win total is 8.5, and under is the only way I would play that. And I actually kind of like it the more we talk. But I'm just because of the offense you've alluded to, the margin of error is just not as wide as it is with some of the other top programs in the country, because I don't think, at least in the past, they were unable to score quickly. Fromm was limited, and it's just where they set the bar, I'm a little down on Georgia. Now, one team that is getting a little buzz, especially because the odds are more enticing, is Florida. Where do you stand on Florida going into this season? Because they're the fifth-ranked team in the country, and there's buzz that they could actually win the conference.
Yeah, I don't know that their talent profile supports being the fifth-best team in the country, but I do understand why a lot of people like them this year. And I think they would have been, you know, talked about a great deal anyway, but given everything that happened with COVID and with spring practice being, you know, limited or non-existent for most teams, with the disjointed practice leading up to the start of the season, I think it favors teams that have a lot of continuity. Mm-hmm. And Florida is one of those, you know, where they've got the head coach who is, you know, basically the offensive mind there is back. The defensive coordinator is back. The starting quarterback is back. A lot of the starters are back. So there's a lot to like about Florida, and a lot of reasons to believe that they might be more ready to play in week one than you know, many other teams would be. And the thing that scares me is that, man, over the last 2 weeks, I've seen, I don't know, somewhere in the range of 10 predictions by different analysts, you know, all over. Maybe some were reporters, but whatever, people who observe the game and you know, having to pick matchups for conference championship games, who's going to win divisions. And I would say 9 out of 10 that I've seen picked Florida to win the East. And that scares me, because Georgia is still the most talented team in the East. To me, it's not even questionable. So, if 5 out of 10 had picked Florida, I was like, okay, you know what? They're thinking in the right direction, but I'm guessing you feel the same way I do. It's like when two.
Yeah, but sometimes it does come to fruition. I know what you mean.
You're right. It's not like those are always wrong, but they do start.
If they're not picking, you know, Tennessee, they're not picking Kentucky. Let me ask you this. Who would you pick to win the SEC with the schedule, with the unique nature of this 2020 campaign?
Well, ultimately, I still think it's going to come down to who wins the game head-to-head between Florida and Georgia, and that's where I would still favor Georgia. But this year, Florida does have a little bit of an edge in that they don't play Alabama in the regular
season. Yeah,
and
their schedule's
much better. Georgia's margin for error is eliminated. So if Georgia loses at Alabama, a lot of people will expect that, but they can't turn around and lose a game to a South Carolina on top of it. You know, that's what would allow them to beat Florida and have Florida still win the East. So that's the thing with Georgia, is that if they lose to Alabama, that's fine, but they better go out and take care of all the other opponents that they're supposed to beat, because if they get upset somewhere, then it really opens the door for Florida.
Yeah, and the Gators get Georgia on a neutral, right? It's still a neutral?
Yep.
Okay. And then they also get Kentucky at home, and they get LSU at home. So that's certainly a favorable, you know, crumble of the cookie, if you will. But
anything can happen. Like we talked about, they have to play at Ole Miss in week one, which there's a lot of unknowns facing a Lane Kiffin squad and all the reasons you mentioned earlier. Am I to believe that Arkansas is as bad as people think they're going to be? Because I think with getting Franks,
yeah,
they could be okay.
He is the only reason that I would hesitate to pick them to go 0-10 in conference. I mean, I think if he develops well enough. I mean, seriously, look. I mean, I feel bad for him because they've gone.
Well, let me preface it. Right, their win total is 1.5. So let me preface it. I was trying to. I'm like, is it that bad?
Well, I mean, think about this. They've gone winless in conference 2 years in a row, and now they're having to win two conference games. You know, where are those going to come? I think if Franks develops, you know, if it starts to click for him better than it did when he was at Florida, then maybe you know he's capable of in a few of those games doing enough to lead them to a win. I believe Mississippi State is at Arkansas. That's one where, you know, I would give them a chance.
No, it's at Mississippi State.
Oh, it's at Starkville. So is it Ole Miss is at Arkansas? Is that?
Let's see. Yeah.
They should be. Yeah. So I mean, of course, as we talked about, I'm not sure that home field really matters that much anyway. I mean, back in the spring, that's kind of what I was looking at with Arkansas is, you know, who do they have at home? It probably doesn't make that big of a difference, but. But yeah, you start looking
travel.
At it.
Travel can be cumbersome, so to speak. There's no Vanderbilt. I mean,
they're not beating Georgia. They're not beating Auburn.
That's the key. There's no
Vanderbilt. They're not going to beat A&M. They're not going to beat LSU. I would doubt they're going to beat Tennessee. They're not going to beat Florida. I mean, keep going on and on. Alabama, obviously. So I mean, there are three games that I think I would give them a chance, and those would be the two Mississippi schools. And Missouri, and two of those are on the road.
Right, they're at Mizzou. So,
yeah, I mean, here's the other thing with Arkansas. Sam Pittman, their new head coach, and I don't want to suggest that, hey, if you were a coordinator, that means you're going to be a great head coach, because we all know that you know that's hit or miss as well. But he's a guy who hasn't even been a coordinator. I mean, he's a position coach, offensive line coach, hired from Georgia. So. How good of a coach is he? We have no idea whether he can even coach on top of everything else that you would already hold against Arkansas. So, look, if you're saying the number's 1.5, I would have to lean toward under for that one.
I would too. I mean, maybe they'll catch a break with, like you said, the opt-outs down the road, but you just can't assume that. What about – so is Vanderbilt as bad as –
Yes.
I feel so horrible. There's no cupcakes on the schedules. There's no non-conference.
No.
And I also, you know, there's going to be some attrition too, right? Like if you're facing dominant SEC teams, now look, we've seen, I'm trying to think, was it Pitt a couple weeks ago that played a running clock against a non-conference?
I don't think that's going to happen in conference play.
You don't think Vandy's going to be like down 49-0 at half and they'll just
they could, but they're not going to do it. But first of all, I think the running clock is illegal anyway. I think they can shorten it. Legally, they can shorten the time.
Oh, that's right. You're right. They did 10-minute quarters. You're right. Thank you. I misspoke. You're right.
But I still don't see that happening in a conference game. But, I mentioned earlier how, like, Mississippi State, for example, I'm a little leery of what FPI thinks. But let me just run down for you. This is the chance to win. I'm not going to do that. That's just bad airtime. Let me give you the games that FPI gives Vanderbilt the best chance. And number one, like I said, Mississippi State, who I believe is underrated by FPI, is still given a 72% chance to beat Vanderbilt. So 28% chance for Vandy in that game. That's the best chance FPI gives them in any game this season. Every other one is above 75% or below 25% for Vandy. So you're talking about a significant upset for them to win one. And that's certainly not to say that it can't happen. Those types of upsets, I mean, some of them, teams that are, that are in the 80% range to win, one or two teams like that are going to lose every weekend in college football. It's certainly not a monumental upset, but that's what you're looking at for about half their schedule. is Vandy's given about a 20% chance to win. And of course, I mean, hey, do the math. That means they should win one out of five of those games. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They have about five of them on the schedule. So will they win one of them? I think that's what this all comes down to.
Oh, man.
It's tough. I mean, they're at a talent deficit, clearly. I mean,
yeah.
With the SEC, almost everyone in that conference recruits at a top 25 level, except for Vanderbilt.
It's really remarkable what James Franklin did, to be honest.
Oh, absolutely. Look, as someone who grew up in Mississippi, I grew up in Mississippi, so I spent my whole life watching this conference. And from my childhood, I'm used to just Vandy getting blown out every game, week after week, coach after coach, decade after decade. And for James Franklin to have, I think it was back-to-back nine-win seasons, like that's unspeakable. I mean, what do you do with that?
And that's coach of the year stuff. I mean,
I can't wait for someone else to
incredible.
Do.
That's incredible.
I don't know if it'll happen in my lifetime, but at some point, someone else is going to lead.
Probably not going to happen this year with Mason.
And it's going to be fun.
I don't even know if win totals are still around. I got to go look that up. I've checked a couple places since we've been talking, and I've sent a few texts, actually. I'm like, why aren't they on the board? So I'm sure they are at some places. I just got a text back from a bookmaker saying, I don't know, haven't had one customer ask for them, and there's a good chance of refunds on any college win stuff. So that's the point. Because if there's any – let's say a team has a win total of five, and they play 10 games and they lose nine of them. If that 10th one is canceled, it's all refunds.
Yeah,
so even if they – if the whole season's not played, even if they mathematically couldn't even do it, it's just the way it is.
Well, and as you no doubt saw, the Notre Dame Wake Forest game for this weekend was postponed. And both teams had an open date next week, but they ended up moving it back to December. And that tells you that Notre Dame would not have been able to play it next weekend either. And now we're getting to the point, and this has kind of been a thing for the first few weeks. It's like, okay, you know what? All these open dates were built in. So non-conference games probably are getting canceled. Conference games are getting just moved to later and they'll be made up. But at this stage of the season, and we know once the Big Ten starts, they don't have any open dates built in. You're going to end up with games just not being played, conference games not being played. And unless things change drastically, it's hard to imagine that at least half the teams in each conference aren't going to end up playing fewer games than were scheduled, because that's the way it's looking right now. So I would imagine that a whole lot of those tickets would end up being refunded anyway. So I that makes sense to me that they wouldn't even offer it.
Well, let me ask you this, because you touched on something and I discussed it on Daily Wager. The Big Ten is really putting itself in a really tight spot, minimal margin for error. And it's more about, I know, the whole conference, but when we're talking the national championship, like, is Ohio State going to get enough votes if they go, like, 6-0? Let's say that the eight-game schedule is reduced, and let's say they do beat Michigan, per se. But, like, are they going to have enough resume to win over some other schools that played a full season or 9 or 10 games?
I think it's a great question. I think it has everything to do with how dominant they look in the games they're able to play. So it's not just winning.
Because they're the second favorite, I should say. It's almost like a co-favorite, them and Clemson.
Yeah, but I think, you know, for Ohio State, if you do end up with games being canceled, whether it's because of, you know, your end or the opponent, it doesn't matter. If the game isn't played, it's not played. And that's just going to put more of a premium on blowing out anyone that is not nearly as good as you. You don't let anyone hang around that shouldn't be. And then even when you do get the chance to play someone who is a top 15 caliber, Penn State obviously falls in that category. Don't be winning that game in the final minute, you know, because anything like, now look, I still think at the end of the day, if they're undefeated, it's hard to imagine them getting left out, but I would say their margin for error for surviving a loss with a limited schedule is really, really thin, you know? So I think that's really going to up the ante when the Big Ten starts. It's going to be, you know, we're so accustomed in the playoff era, any big name school can survive one loss, right? I mean, that's basically been the mark that you're shooting for is be a conference champion in a Power Five league with no more than one loss. And, you know, you're in the playoff. And that's just the way it's been assumed up to this point. but I'm not so sure that would apply to the Big Ten this season, especially if they don't end up playing the, you know, the 8 regular season games that are on the schedule.
So you think a 6-0 Ohio State would get there?
I do, because now let's see what happens with the Pac-12, whether they get in late.
Yeah, and good point.
Even if they do, though, what type of undefeated record would anyone in the Pac-12 be able to put together that would be more impressive than Ohio State? Because they'd have fewer games. Even if they had the same number of games, can you imagine Oregon doing something in 6 games that would be more impressive than what Ohio State would do? I don't know. I mean, I'll say this. The worst thing that could happen for Ohio State would be for the Penn State game to get canceled, because I think that's the one that you can really point to and say, okay, this is their chance to make a statement, to show how good they really are. But outside of something like that, I mean, if they're undefeated, are you going to put a SEC runner-up in? I don't know. I don't see it over an undefeated Ohio State. Now, if it was a team that kind of came out of nowhere and was undefeated, you know, where you had some questions, like, okay, let's say a Minnesota. I mean, not that they'd be coming completely out of nowhere, but let's just say for argument's sake, Minnesota went undefeated and they ended up playing Penn State in the conference championship game, which had knocked off Ohio State, and then Minnesota beats Penn State. I could see there being some skeptics about Minnesota at that point. And then maybe if there's a one-loss team that didn't win the SEC, they take, you know, undefeated into the conference championship game and loses it. Maybe. But outside of that, I don't know. I still think that for the selection committee, the most important number is the loss column. And that has been the constant through the 6 years that they've done this.
Stop, man. We'll end it on that. Can't thank you enough for sharing all the insight and bringing everyone up to speed as we all try to cram for the SEC season. But it was great to catch up above anything else, but also really, really fun to pick your big brain, as Trevor Maddox likes to say.
Well, I just can't wait to see these games played, and I can't wait to see you guys again. Like, all this stuff of talking and not seeing people is I know it's getting to everyone in the country, but one of these days it'll be over.
Yeah, the big brain, Brad's big brain, or the big brain on Brad. Wasn't that a Pulp Fiction or something like that? But we miss you, man. And I was talking to one of our producers last week. He's like, yeah, that does stink. We're not going to have Brad in studio because it was such good content. But we'll hopefully figure out some talkbacks or do something along those lines. And we're going to make it work. Like, we're all staying.
We'll make it work. Right? That's what this is all about. Somehow we make it work.
Yeah, we do. We do. And it'll be good to have just like a busier Saturday. It doesn't feel like it's almost like only like 2 or 3 games on at a time right now on Saturday. Yeah. It just doesn't feel right.
I'll tell you a quick story. My mom, who lives in Mississippi, she's a college football junkie. And she told me a couple of days ago that this past Saturday, she just got so fed up with just the lack of interest that she had in the games that were going on. Like, she wanted to switch the channel, but there was nothing else compelling on anywhere else. She said that she turned off the TV, went to the store, and as she was driving, she thought to herself, when was the last time that I left my TV on a college football Saturday? And her best guess was 1988. Now, that tells you my mom is not a typical mom.
Right.
But that also says a lot about the schedules that we've had in the first 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's reflective also of the passion of the fan bases too, and what they need and what they're used to, the muscle memory of a college football Saturday. But that's all right. You know, we also have our – some things don't change. We still have our Dodgers winning the division. So we got there for the 8th straight year last night. That's really what we should have done the whole podcast on. But, you know, we'll have to sweat out some heart – and probably get heartbroken again this fall with the Dodgers. But But great catching up, man. And I hope your mom has some order restored this Saturday with SEC games.
Exactly.
Back on the tube.
Although, I tell you what, these days, until Saturday morning comes along, I don't know that you can assume that any game is going to be played. So we'll just kind of hold our breath until then.
That's a fair point. Let's not put the cart before the horse just yet. All right, man. Well, good stuff as always, and we'll be in touch.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Take care, man.
Thank you.
Kicking is for losers.
All right, that'll do it, as we like to talk nerdy with Brad Edwards, and he's just so awesome. I hope everyone loves his appearances as much as I do, because, A, he's a wonderful dude and cool guy and fun guy, but also really knowledgeable about football and especially the SEC, and I just feel like I know the conference
as well as I ever could have, having done that conversation with him. So I hope you guys all appreciate it. And again, tomorrow we'll be back with John Murray. I'm hot out of the gates in the baby bankroll bonanza. And we'll also have Matthew and Lou as well to break down the UFC card in on Fight Island.